This is Digital Dave.
And I'm Fast Eddie.
And this is Hot Starter. And that intro just gives us so much to live up to. I'm not sure we're up to it.
Well, it's not happening this morning. I know that.
And we are joined by Captain, I believe,
Captain
Mark Weggie. And I'm glad we got the pronunciation straight because we figured we were going to murder that name. And I didn't want to do that.
We do that a lot, though, in spite of our best efforts here. And you're here as part of the Navy Centennial.
They've been flying for 100 years.
100
and
years.
Boy, are their arms tired.
Yeah. Oh. Actually, you're here to talk about the Great Lakes Centennial and freshwater carriers. Now, I never knew we had freshwater carriers.
Yes, we did. We had we actually had two freshwater carriers during the Second World War. We had during the Second World War, there was a shortage of carriers. We didn't have enough to fight the Japanese as well as fight the Battle of the Atlantic. So carriers were in short supply to do training, and we also needed a heck of a lot more naval aviators because we were building towards a 100 carrier navy in early 1942. So what occurred was a gentleman named Commander Richard Whitehead, who was stationed at Naval District 9, which is where Great Lakes is located, at the station, came up with the idea that we've got this big lake out there, there's no U-boats nearby, and we've got a reserve naval air station just down the road at Glenview. Maybe we ought to put some carriers on Lake Michigan. Well, as I said, carriers were in short supply, so they came up with a very innovative approach. They took a coal-powered side-wheeler pleasure ship and turned it into an aircraft carrier. A paddle wheeler.
Wow.
Wow. That's all they could get that week.
But they got it for a song. In 1942, they bought the SSC&B for $756,000 in early 1942. And it was stripped of its parlors and staterooms and accommodations down to its main deck in Cleveland and then towed to Buffalo, New York, where a flight deck was fitted. And she then sailed to through the Great Lakes to Lake Michigan and was actually parked at or appeared at Navy Pier. And that's where she operated out of. And that carrier was called the USS Wolverine. It conducted its first carrier qualification landing on September 12, 1942. So you can see shipbuilding was pretty quick back then for this conversion. And so we had a sidewheeler aircraft carrier in Lake Michigan. And about 9 months later, in June of 43, she was joined by a second sidewheeler that was converted, and that was the USS Sable, which had been converted from the SS Greater Buffalo, another passenger liner, coal-fired sidewheeler as well.
Now, did these ships actually sail? They didn't just work at dock all the time, did they?
No, they didn't. They sailed all over Lake Michigan, and their job was to do carrier qualifications for fledgling Navy pilots. Their purpose, they were an interesting Navy carrier in that they had no hangar deck. They simply had a flight deck to fly on and off of. They also trained naval deck crews for the carriers. So they racked up some pretty interesting statistics over. They were in service for about 3 years, and they qualified almost 18,000 pilots.
And oh, during, wow. Goodness. That's
in
a
three
bunch.
Years, and then and they also qualified trained about 40,000 deck crewmen as well. So it was pretty impressive numbers. And interesting story. Lake Michigan, as you know, is a gets pretty cold in the wintertime, and depending on the conditions with ice and everything, they may or may not be able to operate. Well, it was given 1943 was a particularly harsh winter, and the Navy decided that they were going to pull the training unit out of Glenview and move it to San Diego to conduct carrier training because the weather was just too bad on Lake Michigan. So during that three-month period they were in San Diego from December through late February, they were able to only qual 240 pilots.
Wow.
Now, during the average, just a monthly average, just doing simple math, because I don't do math in public, and I'm not going to start here. Approximately,
good
they
approach.
Were the two carriers on Lake Michigan were qualifying approximately 500 a month over their three-year lifespan, compared to 240 in three months in San Diego. And it wasn't for lack of trying; it was simply that there were no flight decks available in San Diego in 1943 to land on. Very few. So,
how many takeoffs and landings did you have to make to be considered qualified?
That's a good question. I'm not sure what it was back then. I think it was probably considerably less than it is now. But they were qualified on the carriers on Lake Michigan, and then sent off to their next phase of training, which was typically to a fleet carrier and a fleet site, and then on to fight the war in the Pacific or the Atlantic, depending on which way those particular pilots and deck crewmen were headed.
What kind of airplanes were they qualifying on?
They were qualifying on everything from the SNJ, which of course is the Navy version of the North American T-6. They also brought several formerly frontline aircraft, Avengers, Dauntlesses, Helldivers, Wildcats, Hellcats, and Corsairs, which some of those are still parked at the bottom of Lake Michigan from mishaps that occurred. When you put student naval aviators together with flight decks, and sometimes they wind up in the water, especially back then when you had such a rushed training syllabus. You know, not near as safe as it is now, but we certainly had a lot of them in Lake Michigan, and I believe the number was somewhere near 100 wrecks. And they've been, if you've probably been watching the news on this, they've been recovering aircraft from Lake Michigan and restoring them. And we've got some fairly historically significant airplanes out of Lake Michigan. One here, or just a few of them here I've jotted down, we pulled the world's only surviving SB-2U Helldiver.
Right.
SB-2U Vindicator was pulled out of Lake Michigan.
I remember reading about that.
And it's currently down at the Museum of Naval Aviation in Pensacola as a static display. It's been restored to museum quality. I was down there a couple years ago and saw it, and it's absolutely beautiful. Only one left in the world. If that aircraft actually preceded the SBD Dauntless in the fleet, which of course was the hero of Midway Island, which brings us to another significant aircraft pull from Lake Michigan. They actually did pull an SBD Dauntless from Lake Michigan that fought at the Battle of Midway. And then it was relegated to training duty in the Midwest and was safely stored at the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Yeah, right. And what would the word be? Ignominious? I don't know what the word is.
I was going to say, it sounds like the Navy's
undeserved
got
end.
It's got quite an underwater museum out there.
We certainly do. We certainly do. And in fact, if you ever go to the Museum of Naval Aviation at NAS Pensacola, you'll see there actually is what's called the Treasures of the Lake display, where they have an SBD Dauntless and an F-4F Wildcat at the bottom of Lake Michigan. They haven't been restored. They've simply been put in the museum as an exhibit. And when you walk into this area, it looks like you're underwater. There's fishing nets on them, and you can see all the other trash from the bottom of the lake and sea creatures and stuff. And you can actually see these airplanes as they rested on the bottom before they were recovered. Now, of course, they're much closer together than they were when they recovered them from the bottom of the lake. But they're pretty accurate as to their condition when they were pulled from the lake. And the beauty of Lake Michigan is, of course, it's freshwater, so the metal and the doesn't corrode. And the other thing that's unique about it is once you get below a couple hundred feet, it stays at a pretty constant temperature of about 35 degrees. It doesn't freeze down there, but it doesn't get much warmer than that, so it really inhibits bacterial growth. I was fortunate enough to be at the recovery of another very significant aircraft in November. We pulled up an F4U-1 Corsair. Now, this is you see our Corsairs out here. They all have a bubble-type canopy. And this aircraft that was pulled out last year has a framework canopy.
They called it a birdcage.
That's right. It's called the F4U-1 birdcage.
That's the one I remember reading about.
We pulled it out. It was pulled out of Lake Michigan by A&T Recovery. And I was fortunate enough to be invited up there to watch it come out. And it was incredible the amount of paint that is still left on that aircraft. In fact, the paint is almost still intact. You can read the lettering. You can still read everything on the airplane. It was a little dirty from some algae growth and zebra mussels all over it, but again, the paint was almost perfect coming up. Hard to believe it spent over 60 years at the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Was there still air in the tires on that thing?
I believe there were, yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Just turn the prop over and take it up.
I was just thinking, throw some gas in a fresh battery in it. Let's see if she'll start.
There you go. There you go.
Are there any other plans to go down there and recover more aircraft?
I don't know at this time. Right now, those wrecks are being managed, and they're still owned by the Navy, and they're being managed by the Museum of Naval Aviation down in Pensacola.
So in other words, a private collector like me with a lot of money can't go down there and just say, I'm going to snag an airplane.
Not legally.
Whatever okay. became of the ships?
That's a great question. They pretty much got didn't really get much of a send-off. At the end of 1945, in November, they decommissioned the ships, and by 47, they were all on the way to the scrapyards, and they were pulled apart. They were a throwback to the past, to the early part of the 20th century.
Especially the paddle-wheelers.
Paddle-wheelers and coal power. They weren't much used. Nobody was going to put the money into them to restore them to... passenger liners for the cruise ships for the Great Lakes. Even though I think if you had one right now, you could probably turn it into quite a tourist site and quite a destination for folks to cruise the Great Lakes. But back then, didn't matter. It was scrap metal. There was plenty of ships to be found, and these were just basically anachronisms.
Right.
So.
Yeah,
it reminds me of the movie Mr. Roberts. The crewmen that were on that ship must have thought, I joined the Navy and look where they stuck me.
Yeah, they didn't call her the bucket for nothing.
Yeah.
That's wild, because I never knew about freshwater carriers. I knew there were aircraft that were at the bottom of Lake Michigan, but I had no idea there were over 100 wrecks. That's a lot of aircraft.
Well, considering 18,000 pilots, the ratio is not all that bad.
No, it isn't. But still, you know, some pilots got their feet wet for sure. What kind of did they have rescue boats and everything as well?
They did. We didn't lose many pilots in Lake Michigan. They had rescue boats alongside. They also had salvage barges that follow the ships around. And what would happen is, if an aircraft crashed on the deck, remember I said they just had a flight deck, no hangar deck, so there was no way to repair the aircraft without shutting down the flight deck. So what they would simply do is, if an airplane had a rough landing, didn't go over the side, let's say it stayed on the deck but it was obviously not going to fly off, they would simply crane it off onto one of the barges and they would take it back to Navy Pier, where it would then be repaired and sent back out to the ship or back to NAS Glenview, where it would be reflown again. The ones that are in the lake, of course, were mishaps where the aircraft went over the side, and fortunately on the Corsair that was recovered last year, the pilot did escape. And it was kind of fun to watch that that airplane come up from the bottom at Waukegan Harbor. They towed it in from went down about 30 miles off of Waukegan. They towed it into Waukegan Harbor at the marina there, and they didn't raise it until they had the whole press there, and the man who sponsored it, Mr. Chuck Greenhill, was able to be there to watch it be recovered. And so I was taking pictures of it as it was just set just below the water, about 2 or 3 feet below the water. You could see that birdcage canopy. It was open because when Ensign Johnson left the airplane, he didn't bother to shut the canopy behind him.
Can you imagine?
For obvious reasons.
And, probably didn't even turn off the switches.
That's right. And when you look down there, you could see, again, you could see that paint scheme. You could see everything on it in 2 or 3 feet of Lake Michigan water. And then it came up, and it was a beautiful sight, and it was put on the ramp there, or on the concrete at the marina, and lots of press there. And it was a great day for the Navy to get that old warrior home. And now it's in Pensacola, and it's being restored.
To static or flight?
Probably to a static display.
Yeah.
I doubt the Museum of Pensacola, I don't believe, restores them to flight condition, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I thank you, sir, for telling us all that. That's far more interesting than I would have realized.
Well, thank you. It's been a great opportunity up here. We love to talk to the public about the Navy and all the great things that our sailors are doing deployed. And this little piece of history kind of illustrates the ingenuity, I think, that the Navy brings to the American public and the taxpayers. This was a great idea, and it worked.
Very good. All right, this is Digital Dave.
And I'm Fast Eddie.
And you are listening to Hot Start on EAA Radio.